The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. If you're the average person living in Britain or the Western world that Britain has influenced, you have freedom. Freedom of speech. Freedom of religion. The right to a fair trial. You have free markets, a representative government, parliamentary democracy. You have liberties that billions of other people do not. Think about what your life would be like right now if you lived under some other regime. What would you be doing today if you lived in Iran or Syria or China or Cuba? Other people simply do not have the same heritage of freedom that the British have had. And much of what they do have came about because of the influence of Britain. Parliament's Bill of Rights, the Magna Carta, the social contract. This work influenced the entire free world. And it traces straight back to England. In fact, this heritage of freedom traces back not hundreds, but thousands of years. It doesn't just stem from enlightened or superior English minds. It stems from a different source. We talked about that on Monday's program. Today I want to look at one of the greatest struggles of all time to preserve individual liberty. It was a battle to preserve your freedom. It was one of the most dramatic stories in world history. This summer, we observed the 75th anniversary of that battle. It was a battle for freedom. It was a battle for London. It was the Battle of Britain.
What General Weygand called the Battle of France is over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire.
What did Churchill mean there by the survival of Christian civilization and the continuity of our institutions? He was talking about the survival of the rule of law. He meant the survival of morality. He meant the continuity of freedom for your grandparents, for your parents, and for you. Who was it that was trying to obliterate those institutions? Who was attacking that civilization? Who was trying to stamp out those British lives? Well, of course, it was Germany. It was the fanaticism of the Nazi Party. It was the might of the German military. It was the bloodthirstiness of Adolf Hitler. And who stood in their way? The few, the fighter pilots. In the summer of 1940, the British Empire was in the twilight of its glorious history. It had ruled a quarter of the earth's land surface, and its navy ruled the seas. More than 500 million people owed their allegiance to Britain. That meant 1 in 4 human beings on the planet. Flag after flag around the globe bore the Union Jack. People like to talk about the fact that many people suffered under those flags. But it's just a fact that the overwhelming majority of people under those flags had better lives under the empire. Many of them still admit that, decades after they became independent. But in 1940, just as today, Britain was famously indulging a profound self-hatred. The intellectuals in particular seemed to loathe the empire. And the typical Briton still very much remembered the Great War. The thought of that happening again was too much to bear, so he simply refused to bear it. He refused to hear it from Winston Churchill or from anyone else. He rather preferred peace in our time.
We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The typical Briton had plenty of voices to listen to. He had plenty of voices who said that war would not come. They said that it was time to disarm, to draw down. It was time to look to your own household and ignore what was happening in the rest of the world, or even right across the channel. And meanwhile, the nation that lost the Great War was proud of its heritage. Its leaders were proud of their race and their conquests and their power. They were so proud and so bold that even though it was illegal for them to build an air force, that's exactly what they were building. In the mid-1930s, Germany was building 160 brand new military aircraft every month. 160 German-engineered, high-quality warplanes. Britain had fewer than 500 planes, and most of those were old biplanes. And yet Britain was still disarming. In 1939, when the war started, the RAF had about 660 fighter planes, and the Germans had 3,600. So Germany had Britain outgunned, something like 5 or 6 to 1. And early on in the war, you know the history, the Nazi machine looked unstoppable. It took a matter of days to conquer Poland and Holland, and Belgium. France was the big power on the continent. The French were the ones who could stand up to Germany. And the Germans took them in a month and a half. Britain was next. And Britain was alone.
The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us.
Now, how did Britain react? In the 1930s, everything about its reaction, or lack thereof, was shameful. But here's what happened in May 1940. Britain was on the verge of being bombed and invaded. Britain's Secretary of State for War makes an appeal over the radio. He calls for male volunteers to fight the Nazi soldiers when they parachute in. And before he finishes speaking, thousands of men are already at their local police stations volunteering. Some were 16 years old. Some were 65 years old. In 1 week, 250,000 men volunteered. In 3 months, the Home Guard was more than 1 million. But only a third of the volunteers even had rifles. Britain needed time, and only one man could give it to them, the RAF fighter pilot. The Royal Air Force had to stop the German Air Force. If Germany could win air superiority over England, it could bomb out Britain's industry, destroy its infrastructure, terrorize its people, and land an invasion force. Our late trumpet columnist, Mr. Ron Fraser, he wrote that the British had 3 ill-equipped divisions and about 100 tanks on the ground. The Nazis had 45 divisions and supplies for up to 65 more. So if the Germans could break the RAF, they could conceivably muster a 32-1 advantage. But here's a very interesting chapter in this battle. It happened before the first bomb ever fell. Hitler waited. He waited for several weeks, in fact. This by itself might have changed all the history that happened next. Why did the Germans wait? Hitler didn't really say. But many average, everyday Britons knew why he waited. Hitler hesitated, and Britain finally did what it had waited so long to do. It went to work. Notice this quote from Battle of Britain, page 42. It says, "While Hitler hesitated, the British people rolled up their sleeves and went to work. Weeks of hectic activity followed as Britain steeled itself against invasion. War production began to climb steadily. In the factories, men worked long hours until, exhausted, they fell asleep at their machines. In homes, middle-aged women held filing parties after tea to smooth down the rough edges of machine parts. In school workshops, boys helped rim the edges of airplane seats with hammers that were too big for some of them to hold. Britain woke up at the last possible minute, and then the war came. The war the politicians said was just a scare tactic. The war they basically exiled Churchill for warning against. The war Chamberlain supposedly averted with Herr Hitler. The war the intellectuals had so proudly proclaimed they were above fighting. It started in 1940, 75 years ago this summer. Germany started bombing England day after day after day. And Britain had basically just one option: scramble the RAF. This is who held the fate of millions of people in Britain and beyond: RAF fighter pilots. Historians say the battle came down to the actions of just 1,000 fighter pilots.
I look forward confidently to the exploits of our fighter pilots, these splendid men, this brilliant youth, who will have the glory of saving their native land, their island home, and all they love from the most deadly of all attacks.
Here's how one Spitfire pilot described how he felt when he saw the enemy. On sighting an overwhelmingly large enemy formation, there was a sort of hysterical humor at the hopelessness of the task. Erased almost immediately by the onset of quick, stabbing shafts of fear as the armada of aircraft drew closer, and finally, before joining combat, a consciousness of a thudding and moist brow accompanied by a breathless, panicky fear. Hitler's initial plan was to blockade British shipping, pulverize coastal landing zones for the invasion, and draw RAF fighters into the air and whittle them down. And the Germans were doing that. They were shooting down the British, but just not fast enough. So the Germans changed their plans. They threw everything at destroying the RAF. This is Hitler's War Directive number 17. The German Air Forces must, with all means in their power, and as quickly as possible, destroy the English Air Force. So the bombs started falling on the airfields. The dogfights in the air became more numerous and more intense. Hitler wanted to own British airspace. But the British somehow managed to hang on. The pilots somehow managed to stay in the air. Not all of them. Some bailed out of their planes. Some crash-landed. Others landed, refueled, rearmed. In the air, they twisted and turned and tried to outmaneuver the German fighters. They tried to avoid the machine gun bullets flying at them from the bombers. They tried to knock the bombers out of the sky before they could drop their payloads. Many succeeded in this. Many did not. Britain was losing planes and pilots faster than they could replace them. One book said the fighter command was slowly but surely being bled to death. Only a miracle could save it from destruction. And then a stray bomb fell in the center of London. Hitler had been avoiding central London, perhaps saving it as his trump card, but Churchill didn't know that. So the next night, the British bombed Berlin. You talk about bold leadership. This infuriated Hitler. And he turned his wrath on London. He focused his attention on bombing London. Hitler was hoping that this bombing would terrorize the British people. He was hoping they would reject their government and demand peace at any cost. He was hoping that this would pave the way for the German invasion. But it did something else. It revealed another side of London that's worth thinking about, especially when you compare it to how Londoners today would react to something like this.
August 24th, 1940.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance, one single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. I can see just straight away in front of me Lord Nelson on top of that big column. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue. I'll just let you listen to the traffic and the sound of the siren for a moment. Just a few people here walking rather hurriedly toward the air raid shelters. Some of them casually. A man stops in front of me to light a cigarette. Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are. Just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the portholes. There goes another bus. More searchlights come into action. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. The little traffic lights here, just a small cross on the normal globe, are now red. The cars pull up and stop. I'll just ooze down in the darkness here along these steps and see if I can pick up the sound of people's feet as they walk along. One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes. A taxi draws up just in front and stops, just waiting for that red light to change to green while the sirens howl.
under the Blitz, Londoners actually came together. Whether they were rich or poor, or neighbors, or strangers, they worked together. They repaired each other's houses. They helped each other fight fires. They looked after each other's children. They cooked for one another. London, 1940, was friendly. It was united under the bombs. And the people didn't panic. Week after week after week, they were bombed like clockwork. But the people did not crack. Neither did their leaders. You might remember what the Queen Mother said during the Blitz. The cabinet wanted to evacuate the princesses. She told them this, "The children won't go without me. I won't leave the king. And the king will never leave." Londoners kept calm and carried on, as the famous poster says. Hitler wanted them to be terrorized. He wanted to break their will to fight. He wanted to scare them into overthrowing their government. He failed. The Blitz also did something else. It gave the battered Royal Air Force a chance to catch its breath. Germany was perhaps a week away from destroying Fighter Command. But then the Luftwaffe switched to London. So Fighter Command took the chance to patch up its runways and its communication lines and its air bases. Southern England also got a few days of bad weather, which also offered some protection against the German Air Force. On September 8th, King George VI, he perceived the threat of imminent invasion, and he called a national day of prayer. That would be much harder to do today, even if bombs were falling. A day of prayer! That sounds strange to our ears. But it sounded just right to Britons, who were on the cusp of losing everything. Churchill spoke to the nation over radio. He recalled Britain's history. And what a history Britain has to recall. The defeat of the French and the Spanish at Trafalgar. The defeat of the Armada after Gravelines, Waterloo, Dunkirk. Miraculous victories.
We've read about all this in the history book. But what is happening now is on a far greater scale and of far more consequence to the life and future of the world and its civilization than these brave old days of the past. Every man and woman will therefore prepare himself to do his duty, whatever it may be, with special pride and care. It is with devout but sure confidence that I say, let God defend the right.
On the 15th of September, 1940, Germany massed its heaviest ever formations off the coast of France. It launched wave after wave of fighters and bombers across the channel. The target was the rails and the docks of London, but the goal was to draw up the RAF fighters and finally annihilate them. The Germans began at midnight by bombing London for the 8th night in a row. And in response, the British threw everything they had at the Germans. On that fateful day, the few lost 26 planes, but they shot down 60 German planes. And that was after the Germans had lost 140 planes in the previous week. In the Battle of Britain, page 110, it says, a stunning blow to the Germans. Even the Luftwaffe could not afford to lose planes at such a rate. Furthermore, Fighter Command had shown conclusively that it was not about to be driven from the air. The Luftwaffe commanders, once supremely confident, were now shaken. The German Navy, never keen on invading England, was now even less keen. The Army, confident earlier that it could do its part once the Luftwaffe had won air supremacy was now having doubts of its own. This is a quote from Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding from the Birmingham Daily Post, June 8th, 1942, talking about this incredible victory in the summer of 1940. He said, at the end of the battle, one had the feeling that there had been some special divine intervention to alter some sequence of events which would otherwise have occurred. I see that this intervention was no last-minute happening. It was all part of the mighty plan. I say with absolute conviction that I can trace the intervention of God not only in the battle itself, but in the events which led up to it, and that if it had not been for this intervention, the battle would have been joined in conditions which, humanly speaking, would have rendered victory impossible. Churchill said, Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. Hitler didn't break that island, and he lost the war. The Germans never got across the channel, but the British did. They took the war back to Germany where it started, and they ended it. Churchill himself famously summed up that turning point in the Battle of Britain.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
Why did Britain escape such overwhelming odds? When we read the history of World War II, we read of no bloodbaths in Kensington. We read of no Battle of Cambridge or Battle of Glasgow. We read of no German panzer tanks treading British soil. Why? Is it just because of luck? Is it just because the British boys were better? Or is it because of what so many Britons have said? It was a miracle. It was a miracle that Britain finally woke up. A miracle that the Germans waited, that Hitler hesitated. A miracle that British factories and citizens manufactured enough material to put up a fight. A miracle that less trained, less numerous young men survived against the German hordes. A miracle that the biggest target on the continent endured. A miracle that Hitler stopped targeting fighter command. A miracle that the weather gave needed respites from the bombing. A miracle that the will of the British people, so weak before, became so strong. A miracle that Britain survived. Was the Battle of Britain a miracle? Could World War II have had something to do with divine intervention? Is it possible that your freedoms and your entire way of life has some sort of relation to the actions of God? Now's the time to make a decision on that. Now is the time to prove the answer to that question for yourself. We're 75 years from when the bombs were falling on London. And times today are getting very dark once again. Were our fathers unsophisticated for calling the Battle of Britain a miracle? Are we so much more sophisticated when we try to explain away what they saw and lived and believed? They who fought the war? They who won it? They attributed their survival to God. They say God held the fate of Britain in His hands. They say God saved Britain. Let's look at the history. Let's assess the Bible. And let's prove them wrong. Or prove them right. We'll have more to say on this miraculous intervention on the part of God as the summer progresses. As I've been saying, there's quite a few significant anniversaries this summer, and quite a few lessons that we can take away from history, the history like what we've reviewed here today. You're listening to KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, and kpcg.fm online. Thank you for listening today, and we'll see you tomorrow.